Okay, so I want to start with a story. It was about 2 in the morning, maybe 18 months ago. I get paged. Our payment confirmation service is down. Dead. Not slow, not degraded. Zero throughput.
Oh no. Middle of the night queue incident. I've been there. What was it?
So we had this RabbitMQ cluster, right? About 100 consumers processing payment events off a single queue. And someone had pushed a config change that afternoon. Nothing big, just tweaked a prefetch count. Within about 6 hours, the queue had backed up to 11 million messages. 11 million. And the consumers? They were all blocked, waiting for acts that were never coming.
A prefetch count change. That's a beautifully subtle way to take down a system. What had it been set to before?
It had been 1. They changed it to 1,000. The idea was throughput improvement, and yes, in theory, you'd get more messages in flight per consumer. But what nobody thought about is that each of those consumers was calling a downstream service that had a connection pool limit of 10. So every consumer immediately grabbed 1,000 messages, tried to fan out work, hit the connection pool, stalled, and just sat there, holding 1,000 unacted messages. Nobody else could get them.
So the prefetch increase caused a thundering herd against the downstream, which caused stalls, which caused messages to pile up. And with RabbitMQ, once a consumer holds unacted messages and stops acting, those messages just sit in limbo. They don't get requeued until the consumer disconnects or the channel closes.
Exactly. And because the consumers never crashed, they were alive, just blocked. RabbitMQ didn't redeliver anything. You had 11 million messages in an effectively zombie state.
That is genuinely one of the worst kinds of queue incidents because there's no obvious alarm going off. The consumers are up, the queue looks in use, and the only signal is your queue depth climbing and your end-to-end throughput collapsing.
So today we want to dig into message queues at the level where those kinds of issues make total sense. Not the what is a queue intro, the actual internals. How they work under the hood, what the major systems do differently, and when you should reach for something else entirely.
Yeah. And I'd say the first thing to understand, really internalize, is that a message queue is fundamentally a durability and decoupling mechanism. At its core, it's a way to say, I want to produce this event without caring who's going to consume it or when.
Right. And durability is the key word. An in-memory queue in your process, like a Go channel or a Java blocking queue, is fast, but if your process dies, the messages die with it. A persistent message queue is essentially a managed, distributed WAL, a write-ahead log, with consumer tracking on top.
Let's talk about that WAL concept because I think it's the foundation for understanding why Kafka and RabbitMQ feel so different. In Kafka, the log is the primary abstraction. Every partition is literally a log file on disk. Producers append to the end, consumers maintain an offset, a pointer to where they are in the log, and Kafka just serves reads from that log. Messages are not deleted when consumed, they're retained for a configurable period.
And that has massive implications. Because the log is immutable and retained, you can have multiple independent consumer groups all reading from the same topic at different offsets. You can replay events from the beginning. You can add a new consumer group tomorrow and have it catch up on historical data. None of that is possible with a traditional queue where a message is deleted the moment it's consumed.
Exactly. RabbitMQ is fundamentally different. It's a broker model. Messages arrive at an exchange, get routed to queues via bindings, and when a consumer acts a message, it's gone. The broker is responsible for routing and delivery state. There's no log you can replay.
Let's go deeper on the RabbitMQ exchange model because it's actually quite elegant. You have 4 main exchange types: direct, fan-out, topic, and headers. Direct is the simplest. You route based on an exact routing key match. You send a message with routing key payment.processed, and it goes to every queue bound with that exact key.
Fanout ignores the routing key entirely and just broadcasts to all bound queues. That's your classic pub/sub pattern. Topic is the interesting one. It supports wildcard matching. An asterisk matches one word, a hash matches zero or more. So you could have a queue bound with payment.hash that gets all payment events regardless of subtype, and another bound with payment.star.failed that only gets failures.
And headers exchange routes based on message headers rather than the routing key. Powerful but rarely used in practice because it's more complex to reason about. In real systems, I almost always see direct or topic.
Now, let's talk about what happens at the storage level in RabbitMQ when persistence is enabled. RabbitMQ has a few storage backends, but the main one is called Neija, which is an Erlang distributed database, and for message storage there's a message store process. Persistent messages are written to disk before being delivered, using an append-only log format similar in spirit to a WAL.
When a producer sends a message with delivery mode 2, that's the persistent flag. RabbitMQ writes it to disk before acknowledging to the producer. This gives you durability against broker crashes. But it's also slower, obviously, because you're waiting for a FSYNC.
And this is where people run into performance cliffs. They enable persistence everywhere, don't think about what that means for FSYNC latency, and then wonder why their throughput dropped by an order of magnitude.
Okay, let's talk about the consumer crash scenario, because I think this is where delivery semantics really matter. Suppose you have a consumer that pulls a message, starts processing it. Let's say it's updating a database and calling an external API, and then crashes halfway through. What happens?
In RabbitMQ with manual ACK mode, which is what you should be using for anything important, the message was delivered to the consumer and is sitting in an unACKed state on the broker. When the consumer's channel closes, because it crashed, RabbitMQ requeues that message automatically. Another consumer picks it up and processes it again. This is at least once delivery.
The key word being at least once. The message will be processed, that's guaranteed. But it might be processed more than once. So your consumers need to be idempotent. Processing the same message twice must produce the same result as processing it once.
And that's harder than it sounds. If you're inserting a record, use an upsert with a unique ID derived from the message. If you're calling a payment API, you need an idempotency key that you pass through so the API can deduplicate on its end. If you're incrementing a counter, you need to track which message IDs you've already applied.
What about exactly once? People ask for this all the time.
Truly exactly once is extremely hard and practically involves distributed transactions. Kafka has a mechanism for it with idempotent producers and transactional APIs. You can atomically produce to a topic and commit an offset in the same transaction, which gives you exactly once processing within the Kafka ecosystem. But it has significant throughput, overhead, and complexity.
And in most real-world systems, you're better off designing for at least once with idempotent consumers than trying to achieve exactly once, because the latter requires coordination that touches every layer of your stack.
Right. Now let's talk about a scenario that every queue operator eventually faces, the poison message. A message that causes your consumer to crash or error every single time it processes it. Maybe it's malformed data, maybe it triggers a bug in your consumer code, maybe it references a resource that no longer exists.
This is where dead letter queues come in. In RabbitMQ, you can configure a queue with a dead letter exchange. When a message is naked without requi, or when it exceeds its delivery count limit, the broker routes it to that dead letter exchange, which forwards it to your DLQ. You get to inspect it, debug it, fix your consumer, and then decide whether to replay it.
Kafka doesn't have a native DLQ concept in the same way, but the pattern still applies. You implement it at the consumer level. When your consumer fails to process a message after some number of retries, it manually produces a copy of that message to a separate topic name.dlq topic and commits the offset to move on. Then you have a separate process, or manual intervention, to handle the DLQ topic.
One thing I want to emphasize about poison messages. You need a retry limit. Without it, a bad message will crash a consumer. The consumer restarts, picks up the same message, crashes again in an infinite crash loop. RabbitMQ has a header called xdeath that tracks how many times a message has been deadlettered. Kafka consumers typically implement this with an in-memory counter or by checking a header they embedded on retry.
And you need alerting on DLQ depth. A growing DLQ means something is fundamentally broken, either your data is malformed or your consumer has a bug. Either way, you want to know immediately, not when someone notices a week later.
Let's talk about Kafka's log compaction, because I think it's one of those features that's conceptually beautiful but often misunderstood. Normal retention in Kafka is time-based or size-based. Messages older than 7 days get deleted, for example. Log compaction is different. It retains the last message for each key, indefinitely.
So the mental model is, Instead of an event log, you have something more like a change log or a materialized view of state. If you're producing messages with key user 123 every time that user's profile changes, log compaction ensures you always have the latest profile for every user in the topic, but you discard the intermediate history. Compaction runs in the background and merges log segments.
This makes compacted topics excellent as a source of truth for change data capture, configuration, or any scenario where you want new consumers to be able to bootstrap their state without replaying a potentially infinite history. The consumer just reads all the compacted messages to get current state for every key.
But there's a subtlety. During compaction, you might momentarily have duplicate keys in the log because compaction runs asynchronously. So consumers of compacted topics still need to handle seeing an older message for a key after seeing a newer one if they're reading during a compaction window.
Now let's talk about consumer groups and partitioning in Kafka, because this is where Kafka's scalability model really shines. A topic is divided into partitions. Each partition is an independent ordered log. Producers can partition by key, hash of the key mod number of partitions, or round robin or custom.
Within a consumer group, each partition is assigned to exactly one consumer instance. So if you have 12 partitions and 6 consumers in a group, each consumer gets 2 partitions. Ordering is guaranteed within a partition, but not across partitions. If you need all events for a given user to be processed in order, you make sure all events for that user go to the same partition by keying on user ID.
And scaling is super clean. You want more throughput, add more partitions, and add more consumers. The rebalancing protocol handles redistributing partitions across the consumer group, though rebalancing itself is a disruption event. During a rebalance, consumers stop processing while partition assignments are renegotiated.
Kafka 3.x has cooperative rebalancing, which significantly reduces stop-the-world impact, but it's still something you need to think about for latency-sensitive workloads.
What about SQS? I want to make sure we cover it because a huge amount of workloads run on it in AWS environments.
SQS is deliberately simple. You have standard queues, at least once, best effort ordering, and FIFO queues, exactly once within a message group, strict ordering within a message group. Standard queues can scale essentially without limit and are incredibly cheap. FIFO queues have a throughput cap, 300 transactions per second per API action without batching, 3,000 with.
The key SQS concept is the visibility timeout. When a consumer calls receive message, the message becomes invisible to other consumers for the visibility timeout duration, default 30 seconds, max 12 hours. The consumer has that window to process and delete the message. If it doesn't delete within the window, the message becomes visible again and gets redelivered. Effectively, this is SQS's version of an UNAX state.
And SQS has native DLQ support. You configure a max receive count on your source queue, and after that many failed deliveries, messages automatically move to a configured dead letter queue. Very clean.
SQS lacks ordering guarantees in the standard queue, lacks log replay, lacks consumer groups in the Kafka sense. It's fundamentally a task distribution queue, not an event log. For event streaming, you'd reach for Kinesis in the AWS ecosystem, which is much closer to Kafka semantically.
Let's talk about Redis Streams because it's an interesting middle ground. It's in-memory first, which means lower latency than disk-backed systems, but it also has persistence via RDB snapshots and AOF logs. It has consumer groups that work similarly to Kafka. Each message goes to one consumer in a group, UACK explicitly, UNACK messages stay in a pending entries list.
The key difference from Kafka: Redis Streams don't have the concept of an immutable log that multiple consumer groups can replay independently with equal ease. The data is in memory, memory is finite, and while you can configure Maxlin to cap stream size, you're not going to store terabytes of events in Redis. It's excellent for high throughput, low latency PubSub and task queuing where you don't need long-term event replay.
All right, I want to spend some time on back pressure because it's one of those things that takes down systems when ignored, like our opening story.
Yes, back pressure is the mechanism by which a slow consumer communicates its capacity limits back upstream, ideally without everything exploding. In a well-designed system, if consumers are slow, you want producers to slow down, not the queue to grow infinitely until the disk fills up.
With Kafka, back pressure is somewhat implicit. producers' right to partitions, and if a topic's retention is size-bounded, eventually old data falls off. But producers aren't intrinsically slowed down, the queue can grow. You need external monitoring and alerting on consumer lag to react to back pressure situations.
Consumer lag is your primary health signal in Kafka. The difference between the latest offset in a partition and the offset your consumer group has committed. If lag is growing, your consumers can't keep up. You need to either scale consumers, optimize processing, or reduce producer rate.
RabbitMQ has flow control that can propagate back pressure to producers. When a queue exceeds a certain memory threshold, RabbitMQ can throttle the AMQP connection with a connection.blocked notification. Producers need to handle this. If you're using a proper client library, it'll surface this as a flow control event.
SQS is inherently buffered. There's no back pressure to producers because the queue is externally managed. The operational signal is queue depth. If it's growing, you scale consumers.
Now let's talk about ordering guarantees because this is nuanced and often misunderstood. With SQS standard queues, no ordering. Messages can arrive out of order. Full stop. With SQS FIFO, ordering within a message group, which is a partition-like concept. With RabbitMQ, ordering within a single queue to a single consumer with prefetch of one. The moment you have multiple consumers on the same queue, ordering is gone, messages are distributed.
With Kafka, ordering within a partition, not across partitions. This is actually quite powerful because you can design your partitioning key to guarantee ordering for a given entity. Like all events for user X go to partition hash, user underscore X, while still having massive parallelism across partitions.
The general rule, if you need strict ordering for all events globally, you're basically stuck with a single consumer, which kills throughput. If you can scope ordering to a key or entity, partition by that key and you get ordering plus parallelism.
Let's talk about observability because this is where I see teams really struggle. You have events flowing through a queue, how do you trace a specific request through the whole pipeline?
Correlation IDs. Every message should carry a correlation ID, a UUID you generate when the originating request comes in. That ID flows with the message through every queue, every consumer, every downstream call. When you log anything, starting to process, finished processing, error encountered, you include the correlation ID. Then in your logging system you can filter by that ID and see the entire journey.
And you want to propagate that ID into whatever tracing system you're using, OpenTelemetry, Jaeger, Honeycomb, whatever. Many queue clients support baggage or message attributes where you can carry this context. When your consumer receives a message, it extracts the trace context and creates a child span. Now your traces are end-to-end across queue boundaries.
The other thing you want on every message, a timestamp of when it was produced. Then you can calculate processing latency, time between production and consumption, which is a very direct measure of queue health. If that number is climbing, you have a backlog problem before it shows up in queue depth metrics.
What about dead letter queue observability? You want an alert the moment something lands in your DLQ. And when you investigate, you want the full message payload plus metadata. How many times it was retried, what error occurred on each attempt, which consumer instance was responsible.
In Kafka, this means embedding retry metadata in message headers. Something like X retry count, X last error, X original topic. In RabbitMQ, you get the X death header automatically, which gives you a history of where the message has been.
Let's talk about when message queues are the wrong tool. Because there's definitely a hype cycle where teams reach for a queue when they don't need one, and it adds complexity without benefit.
The clearest anti-pattern, using a queue for synchronous request response. If the caller needs an answer within 100 milliseconds, a queue is almost certainly wrong. You're adding broker round-trip latency, you need a mechanism for the caller to wait for the response, usually a callback queue and correlation ID, and the complexity is enormous versus just making an HTTP call or RPC.
Related. If your consumers are fast enough to keep up with producers and you don't need decoupling for independent scaling, a direct call is simpler and easier to reason about. Queues are a trade-off. They add durability and decoupling at the cost of latency, operational complexity, and observability challenges.
Another anti-pattern, using a queue as a database. Kafka is excellent for this in its specific use case, event log, compacted topics, but I've seen people try to store rich queryable state in Kafka and it's painful. Kafka is not a database. You can't do joins, you can't do arbitrary queries, you can't efficiently look up a single record.
And there's the distributed transaction problem. If you need to write to a database and produce a message atomically, either both happen or neither happens, you need to be very careful. The classic solution is the outbox pattern. Write your state change and appending message record to your database in the same local transaction. Then a separate process pulls the outbox table and publishes to the queue, marking records as published. It's not glamorous, but it's reliable.
The transactional outbox pattern completely solves the dual write problem. Without it, you have scenarios where you commit to the database, then crash before publishing to the queue, or you publish to the queue, then the database write fails. Either way, you have inconsistent state.
So let me try to summarize the architectural decision tree. Do you need event replay and independent consumer groups? Kafka or Kinesis? Do you need flexible routing logic, exchanges, complex binding rules? RabbitMQ. Do you need simple task distribution in AWS with minimal ops overhead? SQS. Do you need ultra-low latency and can accept in-memory first trade-offs? Redis Streams.
And I'd add, what are your ordering requirements? If you need strict global ordering, you're going to struggle at scale with any of these. If you can scope ordering to a key, Kafka is excellent. If you don't care about ordering, SQS Standard or RabbitMQ with multiple consumers.
Durability requirements. If every message must survive a broker crash with zero loss, you need persistence, synchronous replication, and careful at configuration. That means slower throughput. If you can tolerate some loss and failure scenarios like log data metrics, you can trade durability for performance.
And consistency with your team's operational expertise matters enormously. Kafka has a relatively steep operational curve. You're managing Zookeeper or Craft consensus, partition leaders, replication factors, consumer group offsets. RabbitMQ is simpler to get started with but has its own operational gotchas around memory management and clustering. SQS is the least operational overhead because AWS manages it.
Going back to my opening story, the prefetch count disaster. The lesson there isn't just about prefetch counts. It's that queue systems have dozens of these knobs: prefetch, visibility timeout, retention, replication factor, batch size, max in-flight, and each one is a loaded gun if you don't understand what it controls. You need to actually understand the internals, not just follow best practice defaults.
And you need load testing that's realistic enough to expose those interactions. Our prefetch change worked fine in staging where we had 10 consumers against a test queue. It catastrophically failed in production with 100 consumers against a live queue with a constrained downstream. The interaction only appears at scale.
Yeah, and honestly, the sign of a mature queue deployment is not that nothing ever goes wrong. It's that you have the observability to see what's wrong within minutes, the runbooks to respond, and the understanding of the system to fix it without making things worse.
Exactly. All right, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. Ring buffers and walls, RabbitMQ's exchange model, Kafka partitions and consumer groups, log compaction, SQS visibility timeouts, Redis streams, at least once versus exactly once, poison messages and DLQs, back pressure, ordering, observability with correlation IDs and tracing, the outbox pattern, and when to reach for something other than a queue entirely.
That's Claude Talks. If your queue is backing up, check your consumer lag, check your unact counts, and for the love of all that is good, know what your prefetch count is set to.
And page someone who knows the internals. Thanks, everyone.
See you next time.